Chapter 15 was covered by Dr. Jeffrey Kuhl last week. And I propose to give a very quick review of Chapter 15 before we move on to Chapter 16. And Chapter 16 is a particularly difficult chapter, and I don't believe we can finish it today. But we shall see what can be done within the time available. Chapters 15 through 21 actually hang together, and they constitute the second cycle of speeches. If you recall, from the time the friends came to visit Job, what follows is a lengthy dialogue, but it is not a continuous dialogue as we understand it, but rather it goes in the form of cycles of speeches. Each cycle is bound by a common theme, if you like, and then it moves on to the next cycle and the next cycle, and thereby it goes to the conclusion. So keep this background in mind, that chapters 15 through 21 constitute the second cycle of speeches. As Dr. Kuhl would have pointed out to you, in chapter 15, we would be shocked to realize the vitriolic nature of the speech of Eliphaz. And it is so hard to understand how a true friend, the words of a true friend, can turn out to be like barbs and arrows to cause maximum injury or pain to the individual. You would not have forgotten that the three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, having heard of the misery of Job and moved by their common love for Job, undertook what for them in their time was not only an arduous but a hazardous journey at considerable personal inconvenience. They were quite some distance, they lived quite some distance away from Job, and travel being difficult enough in those days, to undertake such a long journey, being faced with natural threats as well as the threats of robbers and thieves, it must have taken a very deep and sincere friendship to move them to go to this extent. And then at the start of the first cycle of speeches, we note the compassion of the three of them. And of the three, since Eliphaz spoke first, we assume that he was the spokesman for the group. And in fact, the words of the other two pretty much echo or in sync with what Eliphaz says. So if you want to know what the three of them were trying to get across to Job, you'd get a pretty good idea by focusing on the words of Eliphaz. And given the motivation that drove them to undertake this journey in the first place, no one asked them to do it, given that motivation, it is very shocking in chapter 15 to see the vitriolic nature of what was spoken by Eliphaz. And we will see that that in itself gives us a clue as to what could be going on behind the scenes. If you break down the counsel, the elaborate details of the speeches of the three friends, if you break it down to its essence, the essence is very simple and straightforward. What they were trying to get across to Job was the law of double retribution is at work in this life. Rightly or wrongly, that was the principle behind all the counsel they had given. What does the law of double retribution mean? If you recall from the earliest chapters, it is simply this. If you are good and obedient, you are rewarded and blessed in this life. If you are constantly rebellious or you refuse to heed the word of God, you are invariably cursed and punished in this life. So the whole perspective, the key to it, is in this life. And that is where, as we saw in an earlier lesson, that is where they were completely wrong. Not that the law of double retribution is incorrectly understood. It is the time frame within which that law applies that has been misunderstood by the three friends. The law of double retribution indeed does hold. The good, the obedient, are blessed of the Lord. The rebellious, the self-willed, the disobedient will finally be judged. But bear in mind that the time frame is God's time frame. Therefore, the mistake comes when you try to confine it to this earthly life. And that is where the friends were wrong. So basically, what they were trying to get across to Job is, cut your misery short. Since the law of double retribution is at work in this life, for you to be suffering this way, you have to be having some secret sin. Job keeps protesting his innocence again and again. That is his integrity, by the way. And yet the friends are equally stubborn because they have started out on a mistaken premise. And all the rest of their reasoning, elaborately constructed as it is completely invalid. But in order to recognize that, they have to recognize, which they were not able to do, that the foundational premise is completely wrong. Therefore, as far as they were concerned, there has to be some secret sin. That is why Job is suffering this way. Solution: confess your guilt to God. And Job kept saying, what guilt do I confess? I would make a mockery of God's justice if I were to confess to something of which I don't even know and of which I am not guilty. And the motivation for confession now becomes important. And we can apply that to ourselves also. Why do we confess, or why are we driven to confess our mistakes and sins to the Lord? Is it because we want relief from punishment? We want relief from suffering? We want to be blessed? Or is it because we recognize that what we have said or done, or even our motive, is wrong in the sight of God? And whether or not God sees fit to give us a blessing in return for our confession is completely secondary, and in fact even, you can say, irrelevant. The important thing is to get right with God. Therefore, there cannot be any ulterior motive driving us to make confession of our sins. And this, I believe, is a principle that we must be aware of even today. The friends of Job were unfortunately blind to this principle, to this concept. As far as they were concerned, in their mechanistic view of the world, law of double retribution, sin equals punishment, goodness equals blessing. You're suffering, therefore sin. If you say you have confessed your sin, that means you are having some secret sin which you yourself are covering up from yourself. Solution: just go and confess to God. If that is the case, the motivation for confessing sin is completely wrong. And that becomes in itself a sin, because you are making confession to God just for the sake of easing the burden of affliction or of suffering upon yourself. And that is not an acceptable basis, because God cannot be arm twisted. God cannot be manipulated. He sees through into our hearts. The friends, as the cycle of speeches went on, you can see the friends became increasingly irritated and impatient because they were getting nowhere with Job. And the reason they were getting nowhere with Job is because Job was standing on his integrity, and rightly so. And they had a mistaken idea of what it would take to get right with God. And their irritation was, look, we made this long journey, we spent so much of time with you, and still we are arguing on this. If you were just to confess your sin, everything will work out well, everyone can live happily ever after. Here again, there is a principle we can draw. Sometimes when we are called upon to give counsel to someone who is suffering or in need, we need to be careful that we are not motivated to give that counsel on the basis of, look, I've given you the best counsel I can, godly counsel I can give you, accept it and let's get it over with. The idea is not to get it over with. The process of counseling is long drawn out, it is very draining, but the motivation is not to get this thing over with. The motivation is to have that suffering person restored. The key driver of counseling, as we will see even in chapter 16, is restoration. Not to clean up the mess as quickly as possible somehow and get it over with. It is the restoration. And the restoration of a person who is suffering and suffering deeply is not a trivial process. It can be a very complicated, long drawn out process. And this, the friends were ignorant of. The other reason for their irritation is one that is common even to us, and that is this. As far as they were concerned, they, and the Bible, the book of Job tells us in fact, that these three were practically on par with Job as far as wisdom is concerned. So they were acknowledged as the wise men of their age. For them now in that station of life, to expend that time, effort and energy and to divest themselves of these so-called pearls of wisdom, it must have been very irritating for Job at the receiving end of their so-called pearls of wisdom to appear as if he is just casting them aside. I give you the best of my advice and you're not taking it. So I have wasted my time and effort. Is that sometimes the cause for our impatience with the person we are counseling? As I mentioned, counseling can be a long drawn out and very draining process. Because we are talking about a fundamental change in the perspective of the suffering person. And for you as a friend or a counselor to effect that change, to effect that healing, is going to take a lot out of you. And if you are not prepared for that, don't undertake this task of counseling. All that said and done, we go back to the question with which we started. What went wrong? How could friends who started out with such a wonderful motivation for helping, how could their efforts be now directed towards the very opposite aim? Namely, they seem to be, without realizing it, tearing down Job. And if you remember what happened in chapters 1 and 2, the answer lies there. If you recall, Satan had asked permission of God to hammer Job as hard as he could. And the restraints were lifted by God in two stages. Stage 1 was only his material possessions were to be compromised. And when that didn't work, Satan went back and asked for further latitude, and that is when the Lord said, one further step I will grant you, and that is I will lift the restraint from you touching him personally, except for his life. You may not take away his life. So effectively, all restraints were lifted temporarily. The protective hedge around Job was temporarily taken down by God himself, and Job was now left naked and bare emotionally, spiritually, to the attacks of Satan. So this is the key to the whole thing. What went wrong? It is the manipulative hand of Satan, which has progressively been turning the words of the friends, driven by honest, noble motives, turning them into increasingly painful, vitriolic barbs that cause increasing pain and hardship to Job. And with that background, we have effectively covered the first 15 chapters. And now chapter 16. This chapter may be short, but don't be taken in by the brevity of the chapter, because there is a depth to this chapter that may escape a first glance. I have tried to analyze it in the way given on the whiteboard. Basically, we can steer our way through this chapter by looking at it as comprised of four related sections. Verses 1 through 4 is captioned "miserable comforters," and that is a quotation from Job's own words. In other words, how not to be a counselor. Verse 5, I call it the golden rule of counseling. Verses 6 through 18 is the tragic plight of Job at this stage, because not only does the world seem to be against, not only does God seem to be against him, everything in the world seems to be against him. Even his three closest friends have now effectively become his best enemies. Job's tragic plight. And the final section, verses 19 through 22, is in the face of all of this, the amazing strength of the faith of Job is to be seen in the fact that despite all the turmoil of his life, he expresses an unshakable confidence in God. We tackle first verses 1 through 4, miserable comforters, how not to be a counselor. Then Job answered and said, I have heard many such things. Miserable comforters are ye all. Shall vain words have an end? Or what emboldeneth thee that thou answerest? I also could speak as ye do. If your soul were in my soul's stead, I could heap up words against you and shake mine head at you. One of the difficulties in understanding what Job says is to figure out at a given point in time who exactly he is addressing, because seldom is it immediately clear or obvious from the text. And if you are not cognizant of the party to whom his words are addressed, your interpretation of that passage is likely to be off the mark. So bear this in mind. The question again is, who exactly is he addressing? The reason the question is posed is because of the mixture of the plural pronoun with the singular pronoun in just these four verses alone. In verse 2, he uses the plural pronoun, ye all. In verse 3, it is the singular pronoun, what emboldeneth thee. In verse 4, it is back to the plural pronoun, speak as ye do, your in the plural sense. Heap up words against you. The you there is the plural you. and shake mine head at you. Job's common style is to use the plural pronoun, and he does that to address collectively his friends, to treat them as a group. That is his usual style. But you notice in verse 3, he reverts to the singular pronoun. What emboldeneth thee? Bear in mind, in the King James English, the translators correctly draw a distinction between the singular pronoun and the plural pronoun. And that is reflected in the use of such words as ye, you, and then thee. In modern day English, this distinction is obscured. It is you for everything, and the context has to guide you as to whether it is a singular, the application is of the singular pronoun or the plural pronoun. So modern English is actually obscure or fudgy in many respects, whereas the King James English corresponds to the precision of the Hebrew, where it's a singular pronoun, the singular English form is used, plural Hebrew pronoun, plural English form is used. So in verse 3, it is a singular pronoun. Since his usual style is to address the friends as a group, after all they came as a group and Eliphaz was a spokesman, who is he addressing in verse 3? What emboldeneth thee that thou answerest? Here we have to infer from the immediate context as well as from the context of chapter 15. Who was the last person to speak before the start of chapter 16? It was Eliphaz. And whose words thus far, whose words had the greatest, most painful effect upon Job? It was Eliphaz in chapter 16. Therefore, in verse 3, it is a fair inference that the D that Job is referring to is none other than Eliphaz himself. And he rebuts the lengthy and painful counsel of Eliphaz by saying that all those words are basically vanity, they are wind. And then he asks a very pertinent question, which again reinforces the point or the assumption that it is Eliphaz alone who is specifically addressed. What emboldeneth thee that thou answerest? This is to be understood in the following way. Given the vitriolic nature of Eliphaz's speech in chapter 15, Job is now asking him particularly, why are you so dead against me now? You were my best friend. I never said or did anything to you. You came of your own accord at great sacrifice to comfort me. What have I said or done during the time we have been together that has made you so dead against me? What emboldeneth thee that thou answerest? So with this understanding, it is clear that he is addressing the friends as a group, but he is specifically directing certain statements of his to Eliphaz. Collectively, he is dismissing these self-appointed counselors with a very stinging oxymoron, miserable comforters. An oxymoron is an expression that combines two words which are completely opposite and unrelated to each other, but which may, with some caution, be juxtaposed to refer to the same thing. So, for example, if you want to draw attention to a particular sketch of a circle, you can say that looks like a square circle. So that phrase is an oxymoron. A comforter is not one who brings misery. And yet Job says you are none other, no better than miserable comforters, which is a very gentlemanly way of slapping Eliphaz on both cheeks. Why have things developed to this point. At this point in the story of Job, we see a contrast of perspectives. What is that contrast? On the side of the friends, as far as Eliphaz and the friends are concerned, the counsel which they have given Job, and basically they have been almost as if they are trying to drench Job, soak him up in their counsel. It's like this: if you want to put out a small fire, you would spray enough water on the burning object so that it not only does the fire go out immediately, but even the possibility of the fire restarting spontaneously is dealt with by soaking the material until it is really soggy. So metaphorically speaking, the counsel of the friends, one after another, barrage after barrage, have been like a fire hose dousing Job with their counsel, hoping to put him down so that he stops protesting his innocence, confesses whatever guilt he needs to confess, and we can all go back home and be happy after that. As far as Eliphaz is concerned, the words that they have spoken are as good as if they were the consolations given by God. And in chapter 15, verse 11, the first half of that verse tells us that this is indeed their point of view. They may not have openly claimed to be speaking for God, but they have got to the point where, without realizing it, they are effectively speaking in place of God. Because in chapter 15, verse 11, Eliphaz says, "Are the consolations of God small, irrelevant, with thee?" What are these consolations of God? God didn't directly speak to Job and give him comfort. It is the friends, the words of the friends. So Eliphaz is really making a very bold and unwarranted statement by placing the counsel that he and his two colleagues have offered to be on par with the kind of counsel and comfort that God, had he spoken, would have offered Job. And that is a very bold and a very rash claim for anyone to make. I don't believe any one of us today, if we were in the position of a counselor, would ever claim in the face of the person we are helping, "I'm speaking God's words to you." That is, unless we were charismatic, we wouldn't use that expression. Charismatic may sometimes claim to speak in the name of God when they offer counsel or consolation. But as Reformed believers, we would never claim that privilege. So that is the perspective of the friends. What about Job? As far as Job is concerned, all of the counsel that the friends have delivered to him have been none other than barbs, arrows, poison darts of misery. And Job goes on to express his contempt for their counsel by using a metaphor which needs to be explained. In verse 4, "I could heap up words against you." If we go back to the Hebrew, it is not so much a piling up or an accumulating of words. In the Hebrew, the word is kabah, which literally means string together, as you would string together beads to form a necklace. So what is Job saying? Job is saying that all of the counsel that you people have offered me, firstly, none of it is original. And worse still, what you people have done is you have taken proverbs from here and there, wise sayings, commonplace sayings, like, for example, "A stitch in time saves nine." These commonplace, platitudinous expressions, and you have just strung them together. First and foremost, they are trite expressions. They are so commonplace that they really have no value at all. Don't even bother saying them. And to make matters worse, you string them together without regard to whether the order in which you have strung these words is logical, meaningful, without regard to whether they are relevant to my situation. You have just piled, not heap up as in the sense of accumulate, you just connect them together and you then discharge these strung together proverbs and witty expressions, and you unload this cargo on me, and you want me to accept it as words of wisdom. If you offer that kind of counsel, you have totally failed in your role as a counselor, because what the suffering person, you must ask yourself, if you are ever in the position of being a counselor to somebody, before you start, ask yourself, what does this suffering individual really need? There are basically, the needs may be many, but there are basically two things that any person who is undergoing great trial or distress needs. Two things. Firstly, sympathy, or if you like, empathy, and support. These are words that cover a very wide spectrum of meaning. And though they are short and simple words, there is a whole lot packed into them. What Job in his situation needs, therefore, is sympathy or empathy and support. But what kind of sympathy, what kind of support? The kind of sympathy that Job needs and that any suffering individual needs is the kind of sympathy that only a true friend can provide. A stranger cannot really provide that kind of sympathy. I once read a true story of an old man who was dying and who had been asking the nurses to contact his son, his only son, to get the boy to come to his bedside. And it appears that in the course of the evening, when all the visitors had gone, there was one last visitor, a young man, who was walking along the corridor, and the nurses in desperation caught hold of him and told him the situation. This old man is dying. He may not last the night. He's desperately looking for his son. Will you come and sit beside him and hold his hand? That way he will die in peace. And the young man obliged willingly. He came, he touched the hand of the old man. The old man was so happy he could barely make out the features, but the old man assumed that it was his son. He called out the name of his son, shed tears of joy, and the stranger sat beside the bed holding the hand of his newfound father until the early dawn, when the old man passed away. But as a stranger, that is all he could offer. He could not offer anything more than that. If we go out to counsel somebody, and if all we can offer is to place a hand on the shoulder or to hold the hand of the suffering individual, it's not much consolation really. And if you think about it, when the three friends first came to see Job, that's basically what they did. They sat down for 7 days and seven nights, quiet, not knowing what to say. They were overwhelmed by this level of suffering. So you really need to be in a position to offer, in fact, empathy is a better word, because it signifies that you not only are pitiful, not only do you pity the person suffering, you know enough about the person, his background, her background, and enough about the details of this ordeal that the person is suffering to be able to feel as the person is feeling, to be able, as it were, to put yourself in the shoes of that person. So that really it includes empathy. It also, the word empathy includes sympathy for, but it goes beyond that because it involves a identification of yourself with the individual. And that makes a very powerful bond which allows you to deliver your subsequent counsel effectively. If there is no such empathy with the suffering individual, whatever counsel that you may offer with the best of intention is really nothing more than words. So empathy is what any suffering individual needs. And in the case of Job, as it is true today, even that kind of sympathy or empathy, if you like, only a true friend can provide. True friend meaning someone who really knows the individual. The second need of any suffering person is support. And really, if you think about it, what can we say or do that can provide support to someone who is in deep distress? A parent who is grieving over the loss of a child through an accident. What real support can we do? We don't have the power to bring that child back to life and present it to the parent. If you think about it, on the human level, the kind of support we can offer is indeed very limited. The best we can do, and in fact we should do this and not offer our support, the best we can and should do is to direct the suffering individual to the one person who alone can give that kind of support, to the person who is the source, the fountain of all support, and that is the Lord God Himself. So in Christian counseling, here is another very important tip to bear in mind. Understand your limitations in terms of offering support. And the best you can do is gently redirect that individual to look up. Because really, it is only God who can provide this kind of support that a suffering individual needs. The kind of counsel that the friends have offered Job, as far as Job is concerned, is really cheap. And that is referred to in the fourth verse because Job says, I also could speak as ye do. And then he goes on to say, if you are in my place, I could do what you have done. I could heap up, string together words against you and shake mine head at you. Besides generating this torrent of prefabricated counsel strung together, Job says, I could also, like you, shake my head at you. The expression shake my head can denote a variety of emotions. It can denote shock, surprise. It can denote pity. It can also denote contempt. As for example, in Lamentations chapter 2 verse 15, all that pass by clap their hands at thee, that is Jerusalem. They hiss and wag their head, shake their head. Here it is not pity, it is contempt. Wag their head at the daughter of Jerusalem, saying, is this the city that men call the perfection of beauty, etc. So in this context, the shaking of my head could either be pity, which is really meaningless in this case, or it could be contempt. If you look at the words that the friends have spoken, there are many trends in the content and the manner of delivery of what they say. And one of the trends, just one of the trends, is this. They started out feeling sympathy and sorrow for Job. But as time went on, you see that the tone is changing subtly but surely from sympathy, which implies some degree of support or understanding. From that, it is changing to, by chapter 15 onwards, to contempt. Because without realizing it, they have now come to the point of saying, if this man keeps rejecting our great and sound and wise counsel, it can only mean that he really is so set in his secret sin that he is blind, he's made a fool of us. And with this kind of understanding of, or misunderstanding of Job, it is not surprising that in the three friends, sympathy has subtly changed into contempt. And it would perhaps have been reflected in their own shaking of the head as they spoke on and off to Job. So now Job is turning things around and saying, I too could shake my head at you if you were in my position. That's the easiest thing to do, is to pour contempt on someone who is suffering. Which leads us to verse 5, the golden rule of counseling. But I would strengthen you with my mouth, and the moving of my lips should assuage your grief. Looks straightforward enough, but to understand fully the meaning of this verse in its context, there are certain key expressions that we need to look at. I draw your attention first to the phrase, strengthen you. Strengthen is the word we want to focus on. In the Hebrew, it is amatz, as written on the whiteboard, and it means literally build you up. So in this context, it means build you up with the words that come from my mouth. Strengthen you with my mouth. It's not literally with my mouth, but with what comes forth from my mouth, which is the word. So I would strengthen you in the sense that the words that I offer you, the counsel that I offer you, would build you up emotionally, spiritually. Moving of my lips is the second phrase we want to look at. The focus is on the word moving. In the Hebrew, it is the word need, N-I-Y-D. And it means literally a to and fro or back and forth movement. In this context, therefore, it refers to the movement of the lips as in speech. But what kind of speech? When a person is agitated, either angry or very excited or very upset, you can tell, even if the upper part of his face is hidden under a veil, just by observing the lower part of his face and the lips in particular, even if you can't lip read, the movement of the lips gives you a clue to the emotional state of the person. If a person is truly agitated, upset, angry, in distress, when he or she speaks, the lip movement of the lips will be very violent. It will not be a steady, smooth, regular movement. So, in Job's case, what he is saying is, if I were to offer counsel as you have tried to do, not only would the words that come out of my mouth build you up if you are in my position and I were in your position, but the way those words are delivered, the way my lips would move to deliver that counsel, would be that my lip movements would be barely perceptible. It's almost like I was hardly saying anything at all, or I was praying silently. My lip movements would be that gentle, that imperceptible. Meaning to say that my words, not only the content of what I would say if I were in your place, he tells the friends, not only the content of what I say, but the manner of delivery would have been different from what you have exhibited. In my case, if I were the one counseling, the content of my words and the manner of their delivery would be directed towards restoring, and that's the key word, restoring the suffering individual. In the case of the three friends, part of their problem is because of their mechanistic view of the universe, governed by this law of double retribution, but mistakenly confined to the time frame of earthly life. So what Job is saying is, you have a very mechanistic view of the universe. But if I were the counselor, I would have a much broader perspective, and because of that, my words and the manner of my speech would be gentle and would be directed towards restoring the suffering person. The third word in verse 5 that we need to look at is assuage your grief. In the Hebrew, it is kasak, and literally it could mean, there's a variety of related meanings. It could mean, most commonly, it could mean to keep in check, to hold back. It could also be to restrain. In what sense? For example, the way that Elisha restrained Naaman from paying for the healing he had received. If you recall what we studied in 2 Kings, when was it? 3 years ago? 2 Kings chapter 5 verse 20 is the verse really which we should look at. But Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, said, "Behold, my master hath spared," that's that same Hebrew word kasak, "hath spared Naaman the Syrian in not receiving at his hand that," referring to the gifts, "which Naaman had brought." So kasak can be either to hold back, to keep in check, or restrain. They are related words, but you need to be guided by their context. So in the present context, what does kasak mean when it is applied to grief? To a suffering person, grief is like being cut by the edge of a very sharp knife. You know the pain that you can suffer from is different from the case of a butter knife versus a meat knife. The pain that you suffer from being cut just once by a very sharp knife, a surgical scalpel for example, that pain is really intense. So in the present context, the kasak, the assuaging of your grief, is to be understood as this. If that sharp, the edge of that sharp knife were to be filed down so that it is blunt, it will no more cause the same degree of pain when it cuts. In other words, it means to dull the edge of grief, thinking of grief as a knife and kasak assuaging the grief as dulling the edge of the grief. So all of these sentiments come together in that golden rule of counseling, which is in verse 5. So when we set out to counsel someone in distress, the following guidelines which I can suggest to you, and collectively they would be our golden rule, which is expressed poetically in verse 5. This golden rule would be useful to keep in mind. First part of the golden rule: be swift to hear, slow to speak. Does that sound familiar? Be swift to hear, slow to speak. It's actually lifted from an epistle in the New Testament. And if you recall, it comes from James chapter 1, verse 19. James counseled, "Ye, my brethren, be swift to hear, but slow to speak," etc., etc. And in fact, if you go back to Job and to the second chapter and you read verses 11 through 13, verse 13 has exactly the same expression. the three friends came to Job, and the first thing they did was not to speak. And that is an important principle for us to remember when we go out to counseling someone who is suffering. Please don't start opening your mouth and unloading a barrage of wisdom. Hear patiently all that the sufferer has to say. However long it takes, don't hurry the individual. Be prepared to spend time. And that is why counseling is a very draining process. Be swift to hear but slow to speak. Part two of the golden rule of suffering, we have alluded to this already. Empathize with the sufferer. Try to enter into his ordeal without condoning or accommodating his sin or error. Empathy doesn't mean you accept everything that the person has said or done, right or wrong. Empathy means you enter into the emotional state, but you still retain that objectivity of judgment, which is what qualifies you to be the counselor. If you lose that objectivity of judgment, you cannot be an effective counselor at all. You become another liability, just like the person who is suffering. So empathize with the sufferer without condoning or accommodating his sin or error. Third part of the golden rule of counseling, the tone of your voice, not just what you say, but how you say it, the tone of your voice must be even and reassuring. Your words must be gentle. When a person is agitated, if you start speaking, your tone of voice is correspondingly agitated, the end result will be two people both agitating each other by positive feedback, and you have one unholy mess that comes out of that counseling attempt. Fourth part of the rule, golden rule of counseling, even if with your objectivity of judgment you can see the sin of the individual, please bear in mind that you are not called upon to convict that person. It is only the Holy Spirit who has the authority and the right to bring conviction of sin upon any individual. Your duty as a counselor is not so much to convict as it is to restore. And these four points, couched in modern language, are actually contained in verse 5 of chapter 16, which is why I have entitled this verse The Golden Rule of Counseling. And with that, we stop our study of chapter 16. We will complete it next Lord's Day, God willing.